Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
We've now entered another cold snap here in the southeast of England. A few days ago, it was actually looking as though it might be warm enough to get out into the garden and do a spot of tidying up. My image of how this is going to be is always rather different to the real experience of muddy knees and soil-encrusted fingernails. In my imagination, I'm always delicately deadheading roses while wearing a very large sun hat and, of course, carrying a hand-woven basket. Welcome to the 7th Dying Arts episode of the Three Ravens podcast, a series all about heritage crafts and forgotten arts. I'm Eleanor Conlon, and I'm off to market with a wicker basket full of still warm, freshly laid eggs over my arm, and I'm inviting my co-host Martin Vaux to take a look inside.
Hello, and what a very nice basket! Now, while I would hesitate to actively call Eleanor a basket case on a recording, it's certainly true that she does like them an awful lot.
I do. Perhaps it's their vessel-like quality, or the way they make me feel like Little Red Riding Hood off to visit Grandma in the woods whenever I carry one, but baskets definitely have a special appeal for me.
Yep, and, you know, with the wild garlic coming up, you will soon go out and gather a load of wild garlic in your basket.
Little brass scissors. Snip, snip.
So, Eleanor, I've got to raise something. Just looking around this room we're sitting in, I can see one, two, I can see multiple baskets. Can they possibly qualify as a dying art when we are surrounded by baskets?
Well, basket making is 100% a traditional craft. It's actually widely believed to be the oldest craft in the world.
Whoa.
And basket making is certainly on the Radcliffe list of endangered crafts.
Is it?
But you're right. It isn't endangered.
Oh.
Basket making is very much in the green category, making it a currently viable craft.
Well, huzzah! Is that our first viable craft in this series?
Yes, I think so. Although it's worth saying that Heritage Crafts did publish a separate report in 2020 about endangered baskets and heritage basketry techniques.
Makes them sound like a wild animal.
Endangered baskets.
We have to look after the endangered baskets.
We do. So I don't think the humble basket is completely safe in our fast-moving modern world.
Oh, no.
But you're right, this is dying arts after all, so I've also decided to include traditional trug making in this episode, which is a critically endangered art.
And let's be honest, aren't trugs just a form of basket?
Martin, how could you? They are wildly different.
Okay, Eleanor, if you say so. But they are both vessels made from natural materials like, I don't know, wood. They also have, like, loopy handles.
They are not the same at all, and I shall prove it.
Uh-oh, the trug champion has accepted my challenge.
I shall take up my withy sword with pride.
So you said just a minute ago that basketry might be the oldest craft in the world. That's quite an amazing claim. what do we know about the earliest baskets?
Well, one of the earliest complete baskets which has been discovered is actually from around 3000 BC, which is quite astonishing when you consider that baskets are made from natural materials like willow, bamboo, straw, leaves, rush, brambles, bark, depending on what was readily available in your particular surroundings. Mm. It's widely thought that the interlacing of twigs of some sort into basket work is older even than the weaving of cloth.
Really? Whoa. Yeah.
And that particular craft has had so many varied uses over the centuries, not just the making of baskets like the ones we use today and are indeed surrounded by.
Yeah. So can anything which involves the weaving of natural fibres be considered basketry of some sort? Like, I'm thinking, for example, of early boats. The Romans had coracles, didn't they, which were basically large floating baskets.
Yeah, totally. And if you think of wattle and daub structures, a building style which was used right up into the 1700s, those are basket weaving skills at work, aren't they?
Okay.
We know, though, that baskets were used even before other materials. So, for example, imprints discovered on pieces of Neolithic pottery show us that they were probably sculpted around basket moulds.
Really?
So long before the invention of the potter's wheel, they'd be using baskets.
That is insane and so interesting. Oh, it's wild to me that some of these really early baskets, from what you're saying, survive. Like, how is it that they haven't rotted?
Well, the oldest extant examples have been found in Egypt because of the heat and dryness of the atmosphere, particularly sand, which has helped to keep them in a good state of preservation. Interestingly, the Worshipful Company of Basket Makers...
No, hold on, wait. Let me guess, is this another Worshipful Company which has no actual basket makers on its books?
No, I think they actually do have some.
Oh, yeah, you think.
But something else they have in their collection is an Egyptian shabti basket from around 2000 BC.
Okay, shabti, I think, are those dolls which people were buried with to serve them in the afterlife. Like, we talked about those in the Puppets episode.
Yeah, that's right. And the shabti baskets were intended to hold food for the shabti dolls.
Oh, my God, that's so cute.
Got to be well supplied in the afterlife, haven't you?
Yeah, that's adorable. They gave the little dolls little lunch pails. Oh.
But I suppose it just shows how absolute a part of life baskets were. I mean, they were literally used for everything. Carrying items, storing, fishing, transporting.
Yeah.
So it stands to reason you'd need baskets for your spirit dolls to carry their afterlife picnic foods.
Of course, naturally. It only makes sense.
Every village would have likely had local basket makers. And actually, Britain was known for its excellent basketry as early as the Roman invasion, with British baskets actually being exported to Rome.
Well, we could do with a revival of basket making today, from the sounds of it. Britain needs all the exports it can get.
Well, your end, Somerset, was actually vital to the historic basket industry because of its wetlands where willow beds were grown.
Okay.
Willow was extremely popular for baskets, although we know that oak and hazel were used too.
Mm.
And Somerset remained a really important centre for the basket craft, even right through the Industrial Revolution.
That's so interesting. And when it comes to willow, I mean, you and I, we've tried to do a little bit of basket making ourselves, haven't we? Weaving things together. And willow is really good for it. Some woods, not so easy to do.
No, some woods, not so easy to do, like that hawthorn.
Yes, that was a mistake.
When we tried to make the hawthorn witch ball.
Yeah.
A great error. Not one of our finest
very
moments.
Very hard to make. Anyway, so how did the Industrial Revolution affect the craft? Because I imagine all sorts of crafty basket-making machines started to be invented, but I can't think of ever having seen one.
Not really, actually. Willow production and basketry actually boomed in the Industrial Revolution, with over 3,000 acres of willow being planted in Somerset.
What?
And there were a great number of craftspeople there as well. I mean, even once willow had been harvested, it still had to be stripped by hand. Far from whizzy machines taking over, the first willow stripping machine wasn't seen in England until the 20th century between the wars.
That's kind of amazing, isn't it? Because
yeah.
I guess it was such a difficult thing to do without breaking the willow. You couldn't shove things into a machine. That's absolutely fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And there are so many associated jobs around the industry, from willow growers to willow merchants, and then, of course, the actual artisans who did the making of baskets.
Oh, good old Somerset, I have to say. Because, of course, when we think about Alfred the Great, he went and hid in those marshes all that time ago, which kind of saved England, or helped to invent England. you know, back in our early history.
Well, absolutely.
Well, I've got a lot to thank Somerset for, not just its baskets. And in terms of the actual making, are there lots of different actual construction methods for putting baskets together?
Well, like Deadly Sins and Wonders of the World, there are seven.
Oh, okay.
Looping, knotting, plaiting, coiling, weaving, twining, and assembly,
right,
which are recognised as the defining characteristics of the craft. But there are other associated crafts and types of regional basket work items which utilise some of the same skills. Mm-hmm. For example, things like withy pots, bee skeps, swill baskets, chair seating, stave basket making, and of course trug making, which we're going to talk about as well.
Yeah, to paraphrase the gangster rappers of West Coast California, trug life, baby. So, also, eel catching, like, that involves weaving, doesn't it? Also,
yeah, in a similar way, like making baskets. Lobster and eel pots would have been basket work, absolutely.
Oh, there is actually lots of different kinds of baskets. I feel like I'm having revelations every minute here. Okay, I'm taking from all this that while basket making itself is still a viable craft, perhaps some of the traditional skills and techniques have maybe fallen out of use?
That's exactly right. Okay. So the Endangered Baskets Report, which we were talking about, discusses the challenges that heritage basketry techniques face and the importance of studying traditional skills in the area to better understand things like historic growing practices, harvesting and so forth. And it also talks about baskets as objects of social connection.
What?
Well, because they were so deeply embedded in culture, they naturally have things to teach us about traditions, experiences and social rituals.
I guess that's true of like most crafts, isn't it? It brings people together.
Well, exactly. And there's also an incredible number of local variations of which knowledge is now extremely patchy.
A bit like corn maidens or corn dolls, I suppose.
Yes. I mean, where else but the Endangered Basketry Report might you find the Wire Forest Whisket or the Penclawith Cockle Basket or indeed the New Haven Fishwives Back Creel, after all?
Well, indeed. I mean, the Endangered Basket Report does make it sound a little bit like panda bears or something, doesn't it?
It's need a very to interesting read.
Like a basket reserve where they can go and breed.
I think that's Somerset. Despite being considered currently viable, though, the industry has obviously declined since the heyday of Somerset willow growing for basketry and since the introduction of widely available plastics in the 1950s, things have definitely suffered.
So is plastic the enemy of the basket industry? I mean, I would suggest that plastic is the enemy of life on Earth in many ways.
That's right, yeah. Oh. I mean, it's obviously much cheaper than growing and preparing willow for basket weaving. But of course, it's not biodegradable, unlike traditional baskets, which can be used until they fall apart and then will gradually turn into compost.
That's it. I mean, you say plastic is cheaper, but not in the long run, because the consequences and costs of all the plastic we've put into the environment are deadly and awful.
Yeah, not cheap for the planet.
No, and not cheap for the healthcare systems, for example.
Well, no, exactly.
Like, we're all ingesting plastic all the time. It's making us iller. Oh, it's all a bit scary. Anyway, so you say the industry has declined. We've got this Endangered Baskets Report. Do we have any statistics to demonstrate what has actually happened to the basket-making industry since this rise in evil, evil plastic?
Well, to give you an idea of numbers, there were 14,000 professional basket-makers recorded in 1891.
Yeah.
And there were still over 5,000 in the 1930s.
Right.
But now it's probably only about 200.
Oh my goodness, that's such an awful drop.
So it's quite tragic.
14,000 to 5,000, mm-hmm. So there's like a third of them left half a century later. And then today that has gone down to, you know, just a few dozen. That is really awful.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that was one of the reasons for producing that report.
Yeah.
Because if you're using that as a scale of percentage, it's going to drop by, think what it's going to be like in the next 50 years, 100 years.
Well, we're going to rally around this, everyone. We're going
to
start
weave some baskets.
Making baskets. It must be done. But, I mean, you said that trugs were actually on the red list. So the story of trugs must be even more tragic if they are critically endangered.
Well, I like to think the narrative has a small spark of hope, especially as trug making these days is a local enterprise to us here in Sussex.
It is.
In fact, we should really be referring to trugs as Sussex trugs, as that is the official name for them.
And just to be clear, what exactly is a trug and how is it different to a basket?
Well, it is a basket in function, but it's made differently.
Mm-hmm.
So it's made of cleft willow for the body and coppiced sweet chestnut for the frame.
Okay.
And the trug is not woven like a basket. It's made from between 5 and 7 always an odd number, thin willow boards fastened together with nails or tacks. And they have a frame and a rim and a handle, and some even have sweet little feet underneath to help them stand up, as they tend, although not always, to be oval in shape.
Yes, I mean, I think the best way to describe them is a bit like old boats. You know, when we think about how boats used to be made right up into the English Renaissance, it was planks that were nailed together, overlapping one another in that kind of cupped shape.
They are very similar to those boats. They come in 10 standard sizes, so you can have a number one trug, which is a very little, short, Eleanor-sized trug, right up to a number 10 trug, which is a much taller, Martin-sized trug.
So we know trugs come from our ends in Sussex, but, I mean, I'm presuming they were a little bit more widespread. Like, they can't have originated here.
Well, trugs are first documented as early as the 13th century and most likely had some sort of agricultural use.
Yeah.
The materials used in the trug, though, are specific to Sussex. So chestnut trees are widely coppiced locally, for example, since they were introduced by the Romans into southern England.
Right, okay.
So it's a Spanish variety, but it was introduced specifically here. And the willow used is also a specific species of willow. It's Salix cerulea, also known as cricket bat willow, because it's used in the production of, you guessed it, golf clubs. Cricket bats. Loads of it grows on the edges of the Pevensey Marshes, where Hurstman Zoo is situated. And that, Hurstman Zoo, is where a man called Thomas Smith established a highly successful trug company in the 19th century.
See, you know, slight diversion, but I mean, when you have like carpenters or other tradesmen going out and carrying their tools, some might call that a toolbox, but if it's open topped, then the official name for it is a trug, isn't it?
Yes, I use a very kind of functional plastic toolbox thing for my hair and makeup supplies, and I call it my trug.
Yeah.
So, but it's not a Sussex trug.
It's not a Sussex trug, and it's not necessarily made out of wood.
No, it's not.
So again, plastic, the enemy. Still, we've driven past signs for the Sussex Trug Company any number of times, haven't we? Is that the one that Thomas Smith established in the 19th century?
Yes, it is, and it's still going today.
Cool.
Thomas Smith essentially did a redesign of the ancient trog, which is an old English word referring to a wooden vessel, which might have been a container or might have even been another word for a type of boat,
right,
as you say.
Yep.
So from the 13th century, trugs or trogs were actually used as measures because they came in different sizes.
Ooh.
So farmers could weigh out different liquids and grains, much like we do when we use cups to make a cake today.
Yeah, of course.
But they were extremely heavy traditionally until Thomas Smith's sleek modern redesign.
Sleek modern redesign. Mm-hmm. I love that you have applied that phrase to trugs.
Well, there was still a general market for Thomas's trugs among farmers and gardeners, but Thomas Smith was the trug maker with big dreams.
Of course he was, yeah.
In 1851, he had a stand at the Great Exhibition at the Crystal Palace in Hyde Park and showed off his trugs to the world.
No way! He went to the Great Exhibition!
With his trugs.
That is so ambitious, because, of course, that was a place for, like, new innovations and machines and engines.
Well, Thomas thought that his trug redesign stood up to all of those new innovations, and away he went.
And I have to ask, like, did it? I mean, did the world enjoy trugs?
The world did.
Oh, what?
At least Queen Victoria certainly did.
Of course.
To all reports, she was incredibly impressed by Thomas's trugs and ordered some as gifts for her family.
Well, that's nice.
Well, the story gets even more heartwarming, because Thomas Smith then returned to his workshop at Hurstman Zoo and was so determined to do a good job for Queen Victoria that he made the trugs she'd ordered entirely by himself, then loaded them into a handcart and walked all the way to Buckingham Palace from Hurstman Zoo, which is about 60 miles, to deliver
goodness.
Them by hand.
By handcart? Mm-hmm. He literally wheeled them, made them personally, and took them bespoke to the Queen.
Because he wanted them to arrive in perfect condition and he didn't trust anybody else. But the Queen was so pleased with the trugs, and presumably with Thomas's single-minded dedication, that she awarded him a royal warrant, a gold medal, and a certificate of merit from the Great Exhibition.
Wow, well done, Thomas.
But the starry trajectory of Thomas Smith, trug maker to the royals, didn't end there.
Oh no, was he on the climb? Was he ascending to the stars?
He was.
Was he going to capture them in a trunk?
Well, in 1855, he was exhibiting them again, this time at the Exposition Universelle Industrie Beaux-Arts in Paris.
What?
Where he took home, alas, only a silver medal this time, but he also got a certificate of merit from Napoleon Bonaparte III.
Okay.
And with these accolades behind him, the Royal Sussex Trug Company flourished and continued to produce trugs right through the increased mechanisation of the 20th century. And while their popularity has declined somewhat since those heady days, there are still three companies producing traditional Sussex drugs today, one of which is Thomas Smith.
Wow. So I'm going to guess the reason for the decline is similar to baskets then. Is it all down to plastic and dwindling numbers of people able to practice this traditional technique?
Yeah, that is a problem. But another key issue facing drugs today is that of the cheap imitation.
Oh, no.
Mass produced in factories rather than handmade in small batches. Mm. Cheap copies have flooded the world drug market, and consumers might not necessarily be aware of the differences between a genuine and an imitation drug.
I've got to say, I love the idea that there is an international drug market.
They're absolutely really is. Look it up. You can buy them on AliExpress.
Oh,
it's horrifying.
Goodness,
do not do that.
Yeah.
But there's also a bit of a problem with the raw materials as well. I mean, drug making is kind of sustainable in that it uses offcuts from cricket bat making.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So cricket bat willow is actually used to make cricket bats, but the offcuts are given to the drug makers to use to make the frame of the trug.
So does that mean that then you're limited to make trugs by the number of cricket bats that are being made?
Not exclusively, but
sure.
It definitely has something to do with it.
Okay.
So it's sort of it's local reciprocity within those two industries. But actually, round here, there's been a downscaling of chestnut coppicing activities, which means like there aren't as many people coppicing chestnuts. So there's just not as many supplies readily available.
Oh, blimey. Okay, Eleanor, I've got one question burning a hole in my pocket, which I'm hoping you'll be able to answer for me.
What is it?
Well, I've been wondering about the origin of the term basket case. I mentioned it at the top of the episode, but I'm wondering, does it actually have anything to do with basketry?
I will tell you all about it, and I will also go rootling around into the forests of folklore to discover baskets in traditional tales right after this.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Right, Eleanor, you promised me an answer. Where on earth does the term basket case come from? And have we been misusing it for years?
Well, I think we may have been.
Oh, no.
I have always thought it referred to being mentally unwell or a little unhinged.
Yes.
But the Oxford English Dictionary corrected me, as it often does. It's military slang, which originates from America in World War I, and supposedly referred to soldiers who were so injured in the war that they'd lost all four limbs and thus needed to be carried around in baskets.
Oh my goodness, because I've seen, you know, people use baskets for coffins, for example.
Yeah, willow coffins are actually quite popular, obviously, because they're biodegradable.
Yes.
But the phrase sort of morphed through the 1950s to mean a person who was unable to cope due to overwhelming stress or anxiety. But it's now come to mean an ineffective and unsustainable body, nation, business, so forth.
Goodness, I've been using it in a kind of light-hearted way, but that's actually really tragic and actually quite offensive.
Well, it is, especially considering plenty of double amputees are able to function.
Yeah,
and sustain as an existence
Absolutely.
In society. So I think it's probably had its day as a phrase.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm very glad that you've enlightened me. And I certainly shan't be referring to you as one of them, even if you do have a lot of wicker work items.
Yes, I think basket enthusiast might be might be kinder.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
I thought for our second half of the episode, we could have a little look at the mentions of baskets and basketry in folktales.
Yes, please.
Well, there are a surprisingly high number of references. Sadly, I haven't yet been able to find any folktales about Sussex trugs, other than the charming legend of Thomas Smith and Queen Victoria. So listeners, if you know any, please send them in.
Yeah, I mean, he's a bit like Cuthman of Stenning, isn't he?
Walked a long way with something in a cart.
Yes. I mean, obviously for Cuthman, it was his mother. But, you know.
I think for Thomas Smith, the Trugs were like his children.
Yeah, little nailed together babies.
Aww.
Now, I can't say that I can immediately think of many folk tales which feature baskets, other than, of course, Little Red Riding Hood with her basket full of delicious baked goods for Grandma. Are there many?
There are. Okay. I will start with this Native American folktale, which originates from the Oregon-Idaho region.
Sure.
There was once a young woman who was incredibly lazy. Every day, instead of helping her elders, she just sat beneath the great cedar tree and watched the world go by. Eventually, even the cedar tree grew tired of her laziness and vowed to show her how to do something with her time. "Watch," said the tree, and it showed her how to take its roots and coil them into circles to make a very simple basket, the very first basket.
Very thoughtful tree.
When she'd made it, the girl was amazed, but the cedar tree told her that the basket needed patterns. She was upset because she didn't know any patterns to weave into her basket, but the cedar tree told her to start walking and to keep her eyes, ears and heart open. So the girl travelled many miles all across the world and she saw and heard many things. The rattlesnake showed her its diamond-shaped scales, the mountains showed her the shape of triangles, and the salmon showed her the slits of its gills. When at last she'd learned to weave all these shapes and colours into her baskets, she returned to the village of her birth and taught all her friends and relatives how to weave the baskets, and she was no longer lazy at all.
Well, that's very wholesome and like a creation myth for baskets.
It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Basketry is actually a major feature of Native American folklore, as I discovered when perusing a wonderful book called Basket Tales of the Grandmothers.
Basket Tales of Grandmothers?
Which is this huge collection of ghost stories, fables, creation myths, and much more, all tied together around the theme of American Indian basketry.
Whoa.
With some beautiful photographs and illustrations. If you're interested in finding out more, it is readily available and very interesting.
Cool.
Moving back towards Europe, though, I found a mention of a Lithuanian folktale called The Gentleman Learns Basket Making, but I've been unable to find a text or a source for it, so we'll have to imagine what that one entailed.
Oh, so it's just a title?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to guess, Eleanor, that it is about a gentleman who learns
how to waltz.
Maybe not.
In the German folktale King Thrushbeard, which is actually a not particularly nice tale about an overly proud princess being taught a lesson through a series of ordeals, basket weaving features as one of the tasks the princess has to complete. Not necessarily the most feminist story, that one.
Hey, could we count the biblical tale of Moses? Because I'm pretty sure a basket featured rather prominently in that one.
We certainly could. In that story, Jochebed is the biological mother of baby Moses, whose days are numbered due to a decree by Pharaoh that all baby Israelite boys shall be executed.
Yep.
So Jochebed weaves and waterproofs a special basket of rushes and floats baby Moses down the river into it, where he's discovered and brought up by none other than the Pharaoh's own daughter.
Yeah, I mean, Moses-style baskets are still very popular for babies today.
I think I was put in one when I was a little Moses.
Although
I mean, a baby.
I don't think it's recommended you try floating your little one down any rivers in them. But it's also worth saying that, you know, that Moses story of being floated down the river in the basket, like, that is a recurring folk tale that comes time and time again. Like, in Oedipus Rex. Like,
yeah,
that's what
exactly
happens to Oedipus, right?
There's a basket.
You know, the same kind of decree or oracle that the son is going to kill his father. So, you know, Oedipus is floated downstream and then raised in a neighbouring kingdom, then comes back.
All unknowing.
Yes.
His true heritage.
All unknowing, kills his father, then marries his mother, then learns about it and pulls his eyes out. Hey.
All the fault of the basket.
Yeah, all the basket's fault. No. But my point is that, you know, this idea of being floated downstream, like, it makes you wonder how many babies were just popped in a basket and floated downstream in ancient times.
Yes. Probably best we don't have statistics for that.
True.
Now, you shared a Chinese folktale on social media last week, which was all about a cat stealing a golden toothpick.
I did.
And a young woman being wrongly accused to hideous effect.
Yes.
There's actually a basket-centric version of that tale, which was retold and published as a children's book in 1885, and is called The Basket of Flowers, A Tale for the Young.
Oh, goodness, it's got a colon in it.
It's the rather moralising story of Mary, an innocent young girl who's an extremely talented basket weaver, who's wrongly tossed in prison and subject to social humiliation after the loss of a diamond ring is blamed on her.
Sure.
Now, this story is actually based on the slightly less baskety folk tale in which a magpie steals the ring.
Yep.
But the basket of flowers replaces the magpie with an opportunistic lady's maid called Juliet, who helps herself and blames Mary. However, there's much description of the beauty of Mary's basket weaving
course,
and obviously her patience and virtue as well.
Yeah, now that subset of tales with animals stealing things and it being blamed on hapless young women, it's also like really dark, but keeps on happening again and again and again, just like the basket downstream.
Perhaps you might, for a bit of a change, enjoy the story of the Pear Girl instead, which originates in Italy.
I'm hoping this isn't a girl that's transformed into a pear and then eaten, because that again would be really, really dark.
No, don't worry. Okay. She doesn't get cannibalised. Once upon a time, there was a king who charged his tenants rent in the form of whatever trade they practised. There was a man who was a pear farmer, but one year he had a bit of a bad harvest. And instead of the usual four baskets of pears he sent to the king, he could only fill 3.5 baskets with his pears. So he popped his youngest daughter into the fourth basket to fill it up and then covered the top over with pears so they all looked the same. But unfortunately, while the girl was in the basket, she got so hungry that she had to eat some of the pears. And when she'd eaten her way to daylight, she was discovered. They didn't eat her, but they gave her a job in the castle as a servant.
I was going to say, I had a horrible feeling that, you know, the basket would be set down next to the throne and the king would just reach down and gobble pear after pear after pear until he ate the baby.
Look, she wasn't a baby.
Oh.
No, she's...
Well, she's a grown woman.
She's, you know, a nubile young maiden,
oh,
as usual.
How big was this basket of pears?
Well, very big, hence the problem.
Been, yeah.
And so she gets this job as a servant, but she's obviously stunningly beautiful.
Uh-huh.
And the king's son, of course, notices Pear Girl. Her name's Perina in some versions, genuinely.
Well, if you eat lots of pears, it's likely to be good for you, isn't it? Good for the skin.
Yeah, exactly.
Wholesome.
Keeps you regular. Anyway, the king's son fell in love with Perina.
Sure.
And her luscious fruit-like complexion.
Sure.
But all the other servants were jealous because the king's son had never noticed them and they hadn't arrived in baskets either.
Well, yeah, but they hadn't eaten any pears. That's their problem.
Well, so they lied to the king and told him that the pear girl had boasted she could steal the treasure belonging to a fearsome local witch.
Oh.
So the king then insisted that she had to go and do it. And so she goes off on a quest to recover the treasure, which results in her winning, defeating the witch, bringing the treasure back, and marrying the prince.
Is this got anything to do with her, you know, powers of vitamin C or?
Well, she, as part of the journey, it takes her 3 days and nights, and each night she sleeps in a different fruit tree.
Oh, does she?
Yeah, and so the first one's an apple tree, then it's a peach tree, and last is a pear tree. And in the morning when she wakes up, there's a different little old woman standing under each tree who gives her something that's going to be useful in defeating the witch.
I see.
And then we have, actually, very similar to your story of Cupid and Psyche, like trials with the grains and the fish and the fearsome dog and greasing the hinges of the door. All your classic fairy tale style trials.
I've got to say, though, it sounds a little bit like this was a fairy tale that was agreed by a committee of fruit growers. You know, all these men who owned orchards were like, we need people eating more fruit, guys. And I've got a great idea for it.
You think this was some sort of collective
conspiracy.
Marketing endeavour?
Yeah, that's right.
I love that.
If everyone believes Perina succeeds through eating all the fruit, do you know what all the other little girls will do?
They'll all eat fruit.
They'll all eat the fruit. Exactly, Charles, exactly.
Alas, there's no further mention of baskets in the story, so a little bit of a loose one. But there is a nice parallel in some versions of the tale, which has the prince then hiding himself in the castle coal chest and telling the girl to ask the king for the coal chest as her reward.
Oh,
I see. And when it's brought up, she opens it up and he's in there and, you know, she has to have him as well.
Does a bit of a reversal.
Yeah,
nice.
Exactly.
I do think that's a slightly tenuous connection to the noble art of basketry, Eleanor. I mean, it's a good folk tale.
Yeah.
I
may have been reaching a little bit, but there were undeniably some rather large baskets.
Yes, I mean, there were baskets.
And large ones.
All right, Eleanor. So let's say I want to get involved in basket or indeed trug making today. I could just have a go at home, look at YouTube, I suppose. But I mean, is there an official way that I should go about
it? Well, you can absolutely learn to make a basket. There are a number of short courses available, but there are also rather more serious professional pathways supported by, of course, the Worshipful Company of Basket Makers.
Of course.
And also by the Basket Makers Association, which is the leading organisation for basketry and its related crafts in the UK.
I always feel like if you're going to set up an organisation, you should try and look for a different set of like initials or a shortened version to another company. Because if you say, yes, I work for the BA.
Yeah, people are going to assume you're involved in aviation.
That's right, British Airways.
No, yeah. No, the Basket Makers Association.
Yeah. But also, that's like a bad confusion to have. Like,
oh gosh, yes. Know, imagine if you booked a motivational speaker for the Basket Makers Association and they turned out to be a pilot.
Absolutely.
That'd be awkward.
Indeed, you asked a really nice like wicker weaver to fly an aircraft. Like, disaster.
Yes. Probably best not to abbreviate in these instances. Mm-hmm. Luckily, they do offer bursaries for skills development in the field and longer development programmes. So you could definitely begin your basket making journey and add your name to the now 248 basket makers in the UK.
That is so cool. 248 basket makers mm-hmm. in the UK. And what about trug makers?
Well, we could certainly go and visit Thomas Smith, as they're just up the road from us, really.
Yeah, not Thomas Smith himself.
No, not he himself. And actually, the company only recently is no longer run by a Smith descendant.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's passed to colleagues, but it's still very much a family business.
Sure.
And they do run short courses, but I was reading about these and they very strictly state that students must understand that attending a two-day course will not make you a qualified trug maker.
No.
As it takes at least a year of full-time work for an apprentice to be able to make all eight sizes of the standard garden trug and a further year to become proficient in making the different shapes of trug, which include flower, fireside log, square, bowl, cucumber, oblong and walking stick.
Walking stick?
Yeah, I couldn't find a picture of that one. Wow. It sounds very intriguing.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Still 2 years is a long time.
If you make all those, you can become a craftsman trug maker, but it takes at least 6 years more to become a master trug maker.
Wow. I would never have guessed that it would be that difficult to become a trug maker.
If we get started now, we might be master trug makers by the time we're 50. Oof,
well, I suppose so. I guess we better crack on then. Thank you so much, Eleanor. And listener, perhaps you're a traditional basket weaver, or you've tried your hand at some other willow crafts, or, like Eleanor, you just like to take a beautiful basket with you when you go to the shops. We want to hear from you. How do you feel about baskets?
Yes, please get in touch with us on social media via facebook.com/3ravenspodcast, Instagram at 3ravenspodcast and X at 3ravenspod. Or you can, of course, email us at 3ravenspodcast@gmail.com.
Yes, that's also the place to send us those entries to our 1,000-word folky flash fiction competition. Get them to us by the end of series 3 and we'll pick our favourites to read in a special episode.
So what can we look forward to in our Something Wicked episode next week, Martin?
Well, we'll be taking a trip to the gory and gruesome world of Gilles de Rais.
I will certainly look forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, if exclusive content is what you fancy, please consider subscribing to our Patreon for only $3 a month or $6 a month at patreon.com/3ravenspodcast.
Yes, please.
We have lots of fun things, including ad-free episodes, text versions of the stories, special Patreon exclusive episodes, including 3 Ravens Film Club, and our monthly newsletter with spells, tarot spreads, folk customs, and more.
If you're enjoying the podcast and have time to write us a quick review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts as well, we'd really, really appreciate it. And if you're a social media raven, come and join us on the 3 Ravens podcast group on Facebook.
Until next time then, while our baskets of pears have been carried off that way, we'll go this way.
And remember, don't whistle until you're out of the woods.
Our theme song is the traditional folk ballad 3 Ravens, performed by Eleanor Conlon and Ben Harbour. And our logo is by Ollie James Dare.
The 3 Ravens podcast is a Rust and Stardust production, produced by me, Martin Vaux. Thanks for listening.
God send every gentleman such hounds, such hawks, and such leman with a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.